Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are we today?
Hey, Sonny, I'm doing great.
Good.
Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you all a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. After you're done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. The great Joe Bob Briggs is cranking out a column for us, and he's worth the price of admission alone, which is low. In addition to being free, there's actually a free option if you guys want to hop on that. That said, we are paying good people for good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you'll sign up for a full membership, which will give you unlimited access, either $2 per month or $20 for the whole year. That's less than most Patreons. And you get so much more bang for your buck. Now, on to the show. First up is controversies and controversies. And we're going to go a little lighter than usual this week and ask an important, pressing question. Should studio assistants get their own Oscar category? Look, sure, for now. They're just asking for more money. That's all they want. They want a little more money. The group Young Entertainment Activists says they deserve a bump in wages because, quote, I'm the liaison between my boss, between the studio, between the managers, between the agents, between the talent, between the crew. Juggling all those egos, that's very hard work. Hard enough to suggest that they deserve recognition from the public at large. Step aside, key grips. Back of the line, best boys. It's the assistant's turn to shine. Peter, should best assistant in a motion picture production come before supporting actor during the ceremony broadcast or after?
What I want to know is, in this hypothetical category, what do the clips look like? Right, like usually when there's a best actor,
it's just outtakes from Entourage,
right.
starring poor Lloyd.
Usually, if it's the best score Oscar, they're going to play the song. If it's the best cinematography Oscar, they're going to show you the most beautiful image that Roger Deakins created that year. If it's the best sound effects Oscar, they're going to show you. Maybe they'll give you a little bit of behind the scenes in the Foley room. But there's no way to determine, based on watching the movie, who the best assistant is. And this, I think, is the real problem for the category. And in some ways, it is, I'm being obviously a little bit facetious, but in some ways it is the actual problem for the assistants, is that it's very difficult for movie watchers and even for high-level people who may not be working with them directly. It's hard for somebody else to figure out the value of a different person's assistant. And so you might see, oh, this mid-level producer who is doing work for me, is that person's assistant really great or not? How are you going to tell unless that person just sort of decides to let you know, my assistant is the best. Please do not hire them away for TK dollars more, this, right? And so it's a real problem for people who are trying to extract value from the system, in that it is unclear to most observers what exactly their value is. I'm not saying they don't have it. I'm saying that it is opaque to people who are trying to figure it out.
No, I joke, of course, but this is, I think this is a legitimate issue, Alyssa, right? Like the idea that assistants should be more strongly valued than they are.
I think in general, support professionals of all kind should get more sort of credit and money than they do. I think it's good when famous women in Hollywood talk about their house managers and their nannies and their support staff and make it clear that the kind of career that they have is not possible without a staff. I think it is good when, people in Hollywood who are making decisions about scripts, like, give credit to the people who read through the slush pile, because those people are doing the first round work and have to do a lot of tough advocacy.
So the people at the front of the train should be sending more protein bars to the people at the back of the train?
But I think that,
or at least nicer protein bars.
But I think there is a difference between saying that the people who make public-facing professions possible should be valued more, remunerated more highly, and saying that the best way to do that, or sort of every class of profession, needs, like, public-facing awards. And in fact, I guarantee you that if there was, like, a best assistant Oscar, there would evolve a system in Hollywood where the one person who won that every year would get like a $100,000 bonus and would get be in competition for jobs, and everyone else would continue to be paid like $24,000 a year and told that like, this is the way you work this up. If you're not the assistant who wins best assistant at the Oscars, like, how do we know that you're really worth a living wage? I mean, it's a weird campaign. And the truth is, like, not every job is public facing or about sort of public credit, right? I mean, I just spent a year working primarily as an editor rather than as a journalist, and I don't need an award for the pieces that I worked on. Like, in fact, that is a situation.
Don't you, though?
I don't. Don't you? I don't. Like, in fact, that is a place where my job is to get out of the way, make the author shine, and let them take credit for their work. And so I think as an organizing tactic and as just sort of like a general principle for being alive, we don't need a best assistant Oscar. That's not a thing.
For the record, I did invent this. I don't believe anybody's actually campaigning for the best assistant Oscar.
See, this that was Sonny Bunch undermining the working man yet again.
No, but I do think that
I'm going to take a little bit of credit here. That was my joke suggestion for this segment in an email before we recorded this episode.
I'm just really tired, you guys.
Please give me the credit.
Really
guys, I want an award for coming up with a
assistant.
Best segment.
Peter Suderman's assistant is the one who came up with this.
Peter Suderman's assistant is the best assistant.
I am my own assistant. No, my assistant is my giant dog.
So really, Fitzgerald should be getting your check for doing Across the
Movie
Aisle.
He deserves. I mean, it all turns into dog food eventually. I do think there is a responsibility of people who run organizations and who make decisions about compensation to look for people whose jobs do not produce easily visible results and yet are incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
And it's a hard thing to do because your superstars are almost always going to be the people who are recognized externally as well as understood to be valuable internally. And yet, the people who just make everything run internally in any organization, anyone who has worked in a remotely large, well-functioning organization of any kind knows that there are people who, from the outside, you wouldn't necessarily know that they're crucial to making the place run. And yet, if you lost them, all of your superstars wouldn't be able to do their jobs.
And also, frankly, and this is especially true in Hollywood, where being an assistant is supposed to be a kind of dues paying. The concept of dues paying is nonsense. The idea that you should take below market value for your labor, and in some cases, I think, like, if you calculated it out by hour, like, what is below the minimum wage for your labor, because theoretically sometime it's going to pay off for you in a different way, is nonsense. Like, that work has value. It should be compensated accordingly. The idea that, like, I pay my nanny more than assistants in Hollywood make is nonsense. And, like, people should be paid fairly for fair labor.
Is this, Alyssa, another instance where Entourage gets it right?
100%.
The movie Entourage? Or the show Entourage more than the movie?
We will someday have to do an episode on my firm belief that Entourage is the most prophetic document about Hollywood, how Hollywood works, and should be given just vastly more credit than it is. But yeah, I mean, like, you watch Ari torment and abuse a series of assistants over the run of the show, many of whom, but particularly the character Lloyd, have like valuable insights, get him access to new markets. And in fact, there's a plot towards the end of Entourage where Ari literally sends Lloyd in to be sexually harassed by a powerful showrunner that he wants to sign, and then pulls him out at the last minute because he can't bear to go through with it. But like, I mean, yeah, like, these are people who do incredibly valuable work without which their incredibly powerful and highly compensated bosses would completely fall to pieces. And they're compensated theoretically by the idea that they're going to get promoted one day. Just like, pay people what they're owed and also make use of their talent. That's a win-win for everybody. If you don't have to replace your assistant every 6 months because you're destroying them, that is better for you because you get more consistent service in a crucial support role. And also, these people have come to work in Hollywood because they have ideas, and if they have good ideas and you let them pursue them, you all can benefit from that. Policies and systems where people burn out and abuse their support staff are stupid for everyone.
And I mean, isn't it? It seems to me that, like, it's a. Let me start over here. In Hollywood, there seems to be an awful lot of tolerance for the abusive geniuses, for the people who are perceived to be extremely high value creators. If they want to be awful to their support staff, there does seem to be more tolerance there than maybe in other industries, maybe certainly in places like tech, but even increasingly in journalism, although there has been some tolerance for the kind of the prima donna, you know, who doesn't treat other people that well in journalism. But I think that's changing, and I think that's a good thing. But Hollywood seems to be like a last bastion of, well, these people are just, you know, they're so high value that what are we going to do?
And I would go even further than that. A couple weeks ago, I wrote a column about sort of what had been written about Harvey Weinstein before his fall from grace. And in addition to the fact that there were published accounts of him sexually harassing people before Me Too happened.
Like years and years before.
Yeah, I mean, in 2004 and 2010. The excuses that people made for him were really fascinating. And it was not just that genius must be that abusive behavior must be tolerated when it comes from geniuses. It was that abusive behavior is proof of both genius and passion, right? I mean, the excuse over and over again for Harvey Weinstein was that he's the only person who could get things done the way he gets them done. And he gets them done by behaving monstrously. I mean, that, and, you know, people made that argument on the record for years. There were articles in business journals about difficult bosses and why they were good and more effective, and the Weinstein brothers were presented as an example of that. So it's more that it's not even just that abusiveness must be tolerated, it's that abusiveness is to be valued.
So, guys, what do you think then? Given the awfulness of all this abuse, don't you think it's a good idea to make a category at the Oscars for these assistants? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy, this suggestion?
I think it's a controversy that we did a segment on this.
That seems right. Also, give all Hollywood assistants $1 million a year and the key to their boss's car and send the Weinsteins to purgatory.
Yeah, I'm glad I read the review last week about how the controversies and non-controversy segment was good instead of this week. Don't want to make that mistake. Speaking of the abuses of capitalism, our main attraction this week is Parasite. Bong Joon-ho's. I'm going to pronounce this wrong every time. So
isn't
I'm just,
it Bong Joon-ho?
Bong Joon-ho. Bong Joon-ho's broadside against capitalism. A down and out family living in a not quite basement apartment in Korea worms their way into the employ of an upper class family, following a series of misdirections and half-truths. The secrets of the household are numerous and may serve as an indictment of the entire neoliberal economic order. Right? Right? Yes, it is. That is right. Heavy stuff, though handled occasionally with a light touch, Bong's movie is at its best in the early going as the scam artists slowly take over operation of the household. Watching the con come together is pretty solid comedy. I found it quite entertaining. And you wonder when it's all going to go wrong, which of course it does. And we'll get to that in a minute. Spoilers ahead. But first, Alyssa, I'd like to ask you, what made you the itchiest about this production?
That is mean. So I was late to watch Parasite because I am insanely busy. And so I have an anaphylactic level allergy to tree nuts. And so I had not been aware that this was a movie where people were going to poison characters with their anaphylactic level allergies, and it really freaked me out. I think this is actually a great example of how trigger warnings can never be all-encompassing enough to alert everyone to everything that might freak them out.
Trigger warning tree nut allergies.
Trigger warning anaphylaxis. But holy God, did that whole plot freak me out. And apparently it's drawn from like a real incident in the director's life in school. He mentioned this in like a Reddit Q&A. He and his friends were told by someone that they had a peach allergy, and his friends didn't believe it. And they threw a peach at the guy, and he had a reaction. So real life peach torture. I mean, as an effective horror movie thing, that was incredibly scary because, like, it's a thing that actually happens to people and, in fact, has actually happened to me. So it was, for me, that running plot thread was one of the sort of most effective horror elements in the movie. But yes, that was the part that made me itchiest, and you're mean for suggesting that, because that's how anaphylaxis happened.
Peter, so this movie is about how capitalism is bad, right? You're a big fan of it, so now you think capitalism is bad. Do I need to get Nick Gillespie on the line here?
I think Nick Gillespie would like this movie, even though, like me, he is a big fan of capitalism, and capitalism is what gives us great international cinema like this, makes it possible for us to see it, makes it possible for it to be distributed and available, makes it possible for it to be funded. Bong Joon-ho's movies are actually quite expensive. The Snowpiercer was $40 million. It was the most expensive budget film at the time that had ever been produced in his country. And so I'm really glad to see, just, you know, to start with, I'm glad to see him being recognized with a Best Picture nomination. I'm glad to see him rise up in the ranks of Hollywood directors. He's meticulous and precise and just a kind of natural filmmaker in the way that he uses space and imagery to tell a story. And I really loved, as with Snowpiercer, I loved the way that this movie was a story about space and about how space defines us and how people use it and how the organization of space, in this case, an incredibly beautiful, elaborately decorated modernist house that has layers of horrors buried beneath it. How that space creates structures for not just individual lives, but for entire social systems. And so he is a guy who's using images to explore social systems and how they interact. And if I have a criticism of him at all, and to be clear, I really liked Parasite, maybe not quite as much as Snowpiercer. If I have a criticism of his work, it's that it's just a little bit too schematic. You know, there's this joke in the movie where the family will see something happen and they'll say, oh, it's very metaphorical. And he's obviously, in the way that Guy Ritchie is kind of hanging a bell on some of the stuff that he does in The Gentleman, which we talked about last week, where he's like, oh, you know, sort of let's make the fact that I think racial caricatures are interesting and funny. Let's talk about that in the film. Bong Joon-ho is doing the same thing with his obsession with the metaphorical power with everything. And it means that the movie is always drawn and driven by this metaphorical schema rather than by naturalistic, organic actions of the characters themselves. The characters are never going to escape from that. On the other hand, that's also kind of the point of his movies, is that these systems are inescapable and that you can never, that the characters can't escape, can't get out of these class-driven structures, whether they are the kind of invisible systems that bind our lives together or whether they are the literal and physical structures that surround us and that we live in every day.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, you know, it's an interesting movie about how class anxiety kind of morphs as you go up the class ladder. And so, I mean, you have, you know, Kim Woo, who's arguably the main character, you know, is anxious about having not gone to university and sort of whether he's smart enough for this job, kind of for any professional job. And then what's fascinating, when he, you know, gets into the Park family, they have the same anxieties about sort of preserving their class privilege, but it's, you know, in a mutated form. It's, you know, English lessons for the younger daughter and sort of exam prep, even though, you know, she's obviously going to university. It's a matter of sort of what kind of university, et cetera. For the little brother, it's this sort of, you know, this sort of idea of a small thing that's been morphed into a large trauma that now needs to be treated in a sort of academic and professionalized way, when it's actually probably not that big a deal for this kid at all. And he's just messing with his family because he's a smart elementary school kid. And so you have these interesting ideas about sort of credentialism that morph up and down the spectrum. But yeah, it's funny. I feel like my thinking about this movie is very inflected by watching it and Snowpiercer kind of back to back. And I had actually expected it to be sort of more of a fairy tale, more of a metaphor than it actually turned out to be.
In what way?
I don't know. I guess I had assumed it was going to be more stylized than it actually was.
Didn't it feel pretty stylized? I mean, he is a director who really takes after the Fincher school of every shot is ultra precise. Every image is ultra controlled. You get this sense that there's never any randomness, any kind of anything that they're discovering in the filmmaking process. He is making the movie that he has seen in his head, and he is forcing it to be the thing that he wants it and expects it and knows it has to be.
More, I mean, part of what's interesting about the movie is that sort of the parks are kind of mundane, right? I mean, I had assumed that we were going to come across something like much darker with Mrs. Park and the dynamic between her and her husband. And the fact that all of the kind of like actual macabreness in the movie is confined to the characters in the lower half of the class struggle.
Well, this sort of
surprised me.
This goes back to part of what we talked about with Snowpiercer, which is that he gets that systems produce complicity and that they force one of his recurring ideas is that class structures that are unequal produce in some ways terrible or at least kind of quite violent survival behaviors amongst the lower classes because it pits them against each other.
Yeah.
And he is, I think, interesting because he's not out there saying rich people are terrible because they're mean-spirited, trying to tear down the lower classes because they want to hurt them. He's saying they're kind of clueless.
Yeah.
They don't really know what they're involved in, and it is the system itself that is the problem. And the only recourse is to escape the system, which he's always like he always sort of asks the question. Can you? Is the system something that we could ever tear down? Is the system something that we could ever escape? And so in some ways, he's not just a sort of very conventional socialist class warrior.
Yeah.
He is somebody who I think takes a lot of those ideas, but then says, actually, it's not necessarily the case that rich people are terrible, that that ownership is what's destroying us, that wealth is making people bad, instead it is that there is this sort of inescapable system that manifests itself in a physical sense around us.
Well, and it's, I mean, to a certain extent, it's that the effects of the system are unequally distributed,
yes,
and that the people who are more desperate end up becoming more deformed by the imperatives of the system.
You know, one thing that I did really like about Parasite is the way the small slights kind of build up over time.
The microaggressions.
Like, it's the cleverest thing about this movie, and I don't love it, frankly. I don't love its kind of ham-fisted ending where, you know, the son is talking about going to college and saving up enough money to be able to like buy the house that his father is imprisoned in. It's a little on the nose and like feels totally kind of divorced from the rest of the movie, frankly. But one of the things I actually really liked was the manner in which we see the kind of like series of low level insults about the smell of the father, who, you know, he lives in a basement apartment that is sprayed with some sort of chemical, and the smell lingers on him. I think I don't think it's just BO. I think it's you know, it is like a function of the place in which he lived. It's the smell of poverty, and the rich owner of the home, you know, kind of wrinkles his nose one last time, and that's what gets him stabbed to death. That is like it's like that one little that one little microaggression too far that kind of ends the movie for him. And I do think that there is something to that, and I think that that is resonant with the kind of our kind of more populist moment, right? That it is not a function necessarily of economics or voting for the person who you think will do the best for you or the best for your people. It is a feeling of being looked down upon and being mistreated. And that is the thing that is more likely to inspire a revolution than anything else. So there are interesting things going on here, but I do think the movie, again, I really like the first half. I basically like everything until they go into the basement, and then I just feel like it gets too heavily handed with the allegory. But it's weird to say that because I actually do prefer Snowpiercer, which is much more heavily handed.
I think the movie gets better in the second half. It gets darker and weirder less predictable in terms of the plotting. And it shows the kind of the darkness that is inherent in this lightly comic schema that we have been indulging in and amusing ourselves with in the first half of the movie. I should probably just add very quickly, like, I'm a libertarian. I'm not really a class war guy. And I take seriously research from folks like Scott Winship and Michael Strain that argues, you know, that in fact, although there is a perception that things are getting worse for the lower classes, you know, that in fact, the poor and the less well off in the United States in particular, but globally, are doing in many ways at least as well as ever, and that intergenerational mobility is at least not down and maybe even up, depending on which stats you use. And yet I liked this movie a lot anyway, not because it sort of agreed with my premises about economics in the world, but because it wasn't trying to just sort of beat me over the head with a simplistic message. What it was trying to do was capture a feeling in the world that is very clearly prominent right now, right? A kind of a left class war sort of sensibility, and do it through the poetry and imagery of movies in a way that I think is really excellent. And I just think he's a great filmmaker, and I think that transcends his, you know, any political disagreements I might have with kind of the underlying premises of the movie.
Well, and I think one thing that the movie gets about the moment is, I think part of what is exacerbating class tension in the United States and elsewhere is not necessarily just the sort of base situation of people in the lower income quintiles, but the fact that they can see so clearly the gap between themselves and other people. I mean, if you are a peasant in France, you're not necessarily getting to wander around Versailles and see all of the details of what you're missing, right? But now, thanks to social media, thanks to reality television, what you don't have is so abundantly obvious. And what Parasite does is shows what it's like to be an incredibly, in even closer contact with the things that you don't have, but to not possess them fully. And to a certain extent, as you see in the house sitting scene, to not know how to possess them fully, right? And so it shows just the pain and discomfort of pretending to that kind of life when you don't actually own it yourself. And I think that is very deftly done.
Agree. The problem is reality television.
All right, fair enough. So what do we think here? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Parasite?
Thumbs up with the anaphylaxis trigger warning.
Big thumbs up.
I'm a modest thumbs up. I liked this movie. I didn't love it, and I can't give it a thumbs down because that first half is so strong. I am a little surprised, Peter, that you... Here, you know what? Can I just throw this out there? One thing I think that trips me up about this movie is that the shift in tone from kind of a standard, almost sitcom-y type movie to like a more straightforward parable for, you know, class warfare up and down the stairs. It doesn't work for me in the way that Snowpiercer does, because it is so straightforward throughout. I mean, the metaphor is there kind of constantly. And it's the same problem I have sometimes with Spike Lee movies. Like, I prefer Bamboozled in a way. I don't know that Bamboozled is necessarily a better movie than Black Klansman, but I prefer its kind of constant, full Spike Lee lecturing mode to the Black Klansman mode of kind of half lecture, half storytelling. You know what I mean?
I totally get you, and I would agree that Snowpiercer is a better movie just because it's such a relentlessly excellent and technically well-executed action film, or at least I prefer it. But I think the shift into darkness is completely warranted by the structure of the film and the structure of the house, which is to say that in order to understand how the depths of the darkness below you, you have to first get comfortable in the kind of light and comfortable, the light and easy environment of the wealthy living above cluelessly. And that's part of what makes the second half of the movie so powerful, is that it draws the audience into being comfortable and clueless about what's really going on below.
All right. Next up is assigned viewing. Up this week, and I'd like to stress again that this is entirely Alyssa's suggestion. This is not me forcing my will upon my unwilling co-hosts. Is Sucker Punch. Alyssa, since you suggested it, again, not me, you, why are we watching the great Zack Snyder's ultimate masterpiece of cinematic filmmaking excellence?
We are watching Sucker Punch because we are setting up for Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of Harley Quinn, which is a girl power ensemble superhero drama, sort of in the tradition of Snyder's movie, but existing as part of a massive franchise. I think you and I are sort of the two Sucker Punch, maybe partisans, in this.
Certainly on this podcast.
And I actually went back and looked at what I wrote about Sucker Punch when it came out, because I didn't necessarily think it was a good movie. But I think that it was notable in just a couple of ways. Among other things, you know, Snyder got Sucker Punch made 7 months after Warner Brothers declared that it was not doing movies with female leads at all. And that is kind of a crazy thing to imagine a studio saying in the present moment. But straight up, I mean, the head of Warner Brothers just said, like, we don't think these movies can sell. We're not going to make them at all. And Snyder went ahead and made an ensemble female-driven action movie with no huge stars at a moment when that was just something that you could say in the industry.
For we should point out that Sucker Punch was not a cheap movie.
No.
I think the budget was something like $80 million. It was like a big movie.
So in addition to being incredibly expensive, it's not just that there are women leads, that they're relatively unknown, that it's an original property, it's not based on a comic book. It is an action movie that functions on a sort of distinctly female logic. This is not a movie where James Bond goes in, kills all the bad guys, saves all the good people at the last minute. It is a movie where the heroines, one by one, sacrifice themselves so that one of them can escape the asylum where they are being held and where they're going to be lobotomized. It is a movie that argues that actually not everyone gets away from these systems, and that for even one person to escape, enormous sacrifices are necessary. And it is, in a way, really sad and realistic about sexism, in a way that renders it incredibly striking to me. It's also worth noting that 40,000 Americans were actually lobotomized. And so this is a movie that, despite all of the steampunk, fantastical, tiny sailor skirt nonsense, is about something that was really done to women, not just because they were actually mentally ill, but because they were inconvenient or annoying to the people around them.
Yeah.
And so it's weirdly a very powerful and poignant and completely ridiculous and kind of failed action movie. And so, you know, 10 years after it came out, I still find myself thinking about it all of the time and about the courage that it took to make it and just how different it continues to be from almost anything ever.
Yeah, you know, I often describe this movie as an interesting failure when I talk about it, like, actually critically, as opposed to, quote, Sunny Bunch on Twitter critically, right? As opposed to being the big cheerleader. Because it doesn't quite work in certain very real ways. And one of the reasons it doesn't quite work, and this might drive Peter a little bit crazy, is that it is almost too intellectual for its own goods. It is operating on an almost literary level of messing with point of view and character. The whole point of the film is that we are all side characters in somebody else's story. You know, Alyssa gets at this with the way that the movie kind of reveals the main character to be somebody else entirely, or at least the protagonist, or the person who is going to escape, who would traditionally be the protagonist in a movie like this, is not the character we expect it to be. But you see that also play out in all of the different interludes, in the robot train interlude and in the dragon interlude and all that. You know, all of these interludes are instances in which the characters are parachuting into somebody else's story, be it a mother dragon or a robot team fighting for freedom or whatever. They are the side characters of those stories. And there were actually vignettes that were made telling all of those stories in their entirety that were extras on the Blu-ray or something. They're on YouTube somewhere. You can probably find them. So the movie is trying to actually do too much. That's its biggest failing. It's great and ambitious, and it doesn't always entirely work, but I'm very glad we got a chance to talk about it on this show.
I think the movie is a failure.
I'm not sure we're running out of time here.
It is interesting.
Sadly.
Yeah. Right. No, this is how you react to criticism, Sonny. It's very telling.
Just have to shut it down.
No, I'm just gonna, you're just gonna like my tweet and then not say anything else. I completely take Alyssa's point about the fascinating feminist logic of the ending. I think that's totally right. The ending is the most interesting part of the story. Too ambitious is not totally wrong. It definitely tries to do too much, but I think that's part of the reason why it fails. I think the biggest problem for me, or the two biggest problems for me, are the interlude action sequences are completely sterile and empty. They don't really have much to do with anything. And so when you, the thing that I like most about this movie, just besides the kind of the impressive imagery overall, is the way it maps the cat house brothel setting onto the mental hospital that Baby Doll is in. And so, right. And so you can see how those sets are dressed in one way at first, you know, in their sort of realistic, very dark and grimy and gritty way. And then they become something else. She sees them as something different, but the train sequence doesn't have anything. It doesn't map onto anything. It's just there because it's a cool robot train sequence. The dragon sequence doesn't map onto anything. It's a totally empty exercise in kind of video game action logic.
But
and there's
that is,
just not that,
is,
that much to it.
That is, I would argue that is at least part of the point. If you remember, each of those sequences kicks off with Scott Glenn's character, the wise man, uttering a complete banality. Like just an objective banality. Stuff like, if we don't stick together, we'll fall apart. I can't remember what the actual lines are, but each of them is like a total generic line that really means nothing.
But do you think
I think the point of each of those sequences, which if you'll notice, each kind of tackle a different genre, right? The robot train sequence is a sci-fi Matrix type movie. The assault on the through the trenches is basically a war movie with some steampunk trappings. You have a ninja movie with the assault on the robot samurai, and then you have the medieval kind of like Lord of the Rings style movie. All of which map very closely to big budget action movies that had been popular within the last 10 years of that movie coming out. I think the kind of genericness of them is almost the point.
I think the director who so wildly misunderstood and misinterpreted Watchmen can't say that he is trying to make some clever point about genre cinema of the era. Instead, what he's trying to do is replicate it and make it brutal and cool and interesting in the way that he likes things to be brutal and cool and interesting. And it ends up, as always, being stylistically like cool to look at and totally empty. And then this brings me to the other thing that I don't like about it is that the characters themselves, with the kind of exception of Oscar Isaac's sort of pimp orderly, end up being completely empty and shallow characters what could you say about Sweet Pea or Baby Doll or any of the rest? What could you tell me how they would behave in any circumstance that isn't the one that they are being put in? They have almost no meaningful characters or characteristics. Instead, what they have You have the two blondes who are sort of competing for the leadership role, and then you have some supporting characters who are just there as supporting characters and don't really have any personalities. You can't imagine them off screen. You can't imagine them anywhere else. The movie just sort of treats them like action figures.
The exception to that, I think, is probably Jenna Malone's character, who, like, Jenna Malone is one of those actresses who I think is just, like, consistently kind of underrated and underused, and I don't know that Hollywood has figured out what to do with her, but...
But that's her performance. That's not the script, and it's not the direction. That's the fact that she is a good performer, and so she builds something into what's not there.
Yeah.
But this... But I found the movie... totally disconnecting. It's not very interesting to watch because in the end it just feels like a trailer for a bunch of movies or video games that I might want to play or see, but never, it doesn't actually deliver on any of the ideas. It doesn't make them meaningful because the characters are so empty and so blank.
Peter, let me ask you a question. Did you watch the theatrical cut or the extended cut?
Obviously, I watched the theatrical cut because I didn't want to spend any more time with this movie than I had to.
Oh, Peter, see, you have made a huge mistake. You missed out on the whole song and dance number with Oscar Isaac. You missed out on the extended John Hamm sequence. See, your opinion on this is not valid because you've not watched the movie in its proper form. All right, we'll move on. I wish I had known this at the beginning. I would have cut you off for real.
just as I think that, you know, as with Pain and Gain, Michael Bay has revealed that, like, there's a great sort of, like, vulgar, low-budget filmmaker lying within him. Like, this movie has always made me think that Zack Snyder, like, secretly has the soul of someone who, like, kind of should be making feminist movies for Sundance.
Zack Snyder's Little Women. Would watch.
Isn't that basically what this is?
Would watch.
It's not an accident that his best movie is the Dawn of the Dead remake. It's a vulgar, you know, like, interestingly kind of crude and violent, lower-budget horror action film where his sensibility actually works and where the CG stylishness doesn't overwhelm everything else. I dislike
you
Sucker
mispronounced
Punch for many of the same reasons that I dislike 300, another movie that looks pretty cool at times, but I find completely distancing and disengaging. I just don't find myself invested in anything that happens. The thing that I care about while watching 300 is that I want not for any of the sides to win or lose, but for the movie to be over.
And yet, despite all of this, there is something totally bizarre and fascinating about the fact that Zack Snyder has made a movie that does more that is different and feminine in its logic than anything that... I mean, I would just put $50 on this being more interesting in its upending of action movie logic than anything Birds of Prey will do and that anything Black Widow will do. And I don't entirely know what to make of that or to do with that, but I can't stop thinking about it.
I'll give you Birds of Prey because, though we haven't seen it yet.
We haven't seen it. We don't have any
idea. I'll give you Birds of Prey because DC doesn't know what to do with its characters. But if you want to see an example of a great feminist action movie, the best one I think, you know, ever is Aliens. And we've talked about it here on this podcast, and I absolutely love that movie because it gives its female lead it makes her so memorable and so distinct and human. In a way that Zack Snyder just doesn't care enough about people to even... It's like he couldn't even think about doing that. He has no idea. It's not even that he tries and fails. It's that it would never even occur to him to make a character as human and as multi-side, you know, multi-dimensional as Sigourney Weaver, as Ripley is in Aliens.
And
terrible, terrible way to talk about the man who humanized Rorschach.
And I agree with you that Aliens does that with character, but it doesn't do it with the movie logic, right? I mean, like, Ripley fights and she wins. She survives. She saves Newt. Like, she...
But the movie logic is built around mothers protecting their families. It is a movie about two women fighting for sort of motherly ideals and motherly visions of the world, and yet also being amazing action heroes in the process and being better than the men. And I mean, Michael Biehn's character takes the traditional female role who kind of gets sidelined for the third act while the male protagonist goes in and fights the bad guy.
But at the same time, like, the motherly instinct is the way in which women traditionally have permission to act like men in action movies, right? It's, I mean, it's extraordinarily well done, but it still kind of exists within that framework.
In Sucker Punch, I mean, yeah. I agree with that to some extent, and yet in Sucker Punch, they're not acting like women. They're acting like cartoon characters who don't actually have, who don't exist outside of the action fantasies that we are seeing them enact on screen. And if they were acting like characters who you could imagine in some other circumstance, who had any human attributes of note at all, I think I would be more inclined to give this movie some more credit on that front. But instead, they're just action figures. They are little. She's literally a doll that Zack Snyder just wants to pose and play with and see in these incredibly cool looking action scenarios.
Okay, Peter's wrong. Next week's assigned viewing is The Jungle Book, which we are watching ahead of another CGI animal movie, Call of the Wild. So a lot to look forward to there. Hopefully you heard me roll my eyes over the phone there, guys. All right, that's it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews, people. If you didn't love it, complain to me on Twitter, at Sunny Bunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.